And welcome to the Comics Canon, the podcast that reads, reviews, and renders judgment on the greatest comic book stories of yesterday and today. In this episode, we travel back a long time ago to a galaxy far, far away as we discuss Darth Vader Volume 1, collecting issues number 1 through 6 of the recently concluded series by Marvel Comics. Join us as we ask the burning questions: how good is this story really? And does it belong in that body of great comic book works known as the Comics Canon? My name is Kevin Morrow.
And my name is Kurt Holman. And Kevin?
Yes, Kurt?
I find your lack of faith disturbing.
Many people do.
Actually, you had a pretty good amount of faith in our changes to the schedule, because we had originally planned to do Darth Vader a few weeks ago, and then we realized that we kind of wanted our year in review 2017 preview episode to go in that slot, so we bumped
to come out at the end of the year.
Yeah,
and rather than in 2017.
Yeah, so we bumped Darth Vader a little bit further. We originally scheduled it to tie in with the movie Rogue One, which may or may not have an appearance by everyone's favorite Sith Lord. You know, I'll be vague about it, you know, still. And we planned that like months ago, you know, but so we're bumping it now. And I think that Star Wars still might have a little relevance, you know, in pop culture, even though it's in early January. Maybe. People won't have forgotten. I don't
know. Now, let's roll back a minute. Are you saying that Darth Maul is in Rogue One?
Not Darth Maul. He was cut in half at the end of The Phantom Menace, of course.
Yeah. But you did say everybody's favorite Sith.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, that's right. So before we get into it, should we talk maybe a little bit about our histories with Star Wars? Because I think I'm maybe a little bit more of a Star Wars person than you are.
That's so, very fair. Yeah. I'll go first. Mm-hmm. I like Star Wars a lot, much more when I was younger. Mm-hmm. And when The Empire Strikes Back came out, that was like my godfather, mm-hmm. my godfather too. Uh-huh. I remember I'm old enough to have had to, well, I guess you could still do this today, but some friends and I, after school, caught a bus to go to the movie theater to see it for like the second or third time, you know, on a school day. Mm-hmm. There's no reason why you kids today can't do that, I suppose. But that was my level of commitment to seeing this movie, which, you know, I wasn't going to do for, you know, I don't know, Gremlins or what have you. Also, my dad kind of raised me to appreciate cliffhanger serials of the kind that he saw, you know, in the theater.
Your Flash Gordons and your Buck Rogerses.
Yeah, and I've always been a Flash Gordon fan, you know, the original Alex Raymond stuff, and then various, you know, I would buy paperbacks of, like, the syndicated strip, you know, after it had moved on and been taken over and corporatized by other people, and seen the, you know, the famous Flash Gordon movie probably like 25 times, and always see pretty much every iteration of it. So I was programmed to like the kind of cliffhanger serial aspect of Empire. After that, I kind of dropped off. I like it just fine. Return of the Jedi, you know, felt a little too kiddie for me. And I think maybe for that reason, and I got into other things, Doctor Who and what have you, and didn't really follow the expanded universe all that closely. I've never seen Clone Wars, although I've been told it's good. I think I read like the, is it Kevin J. Anderson or Timothy Zahn, the Admiral Thrawn?
I don't know novels. Which one did those. I have not read those myself, you know.
I might have read, I think both of those guys wrote Star Wars books, and I might have read some from each. But I mean, aside from reading the Han Solo series by, I think it was Brian Daley, and Splinter of the Mind's Eye by Alan Dean Foster. Those are probably the only old expanded universe things I've ever really gotten into.
Yeah, because I've always think of you as being more of a music geek, and I'm kind of more of a sci-fi geek, and obviously we're both equally comic book geeks.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong, I am a sci-fi geek, but there were other things certainly took precedence.
Yeah. And for me, you know, I was like super on board when the first Star Wars came out, but I'm a couple years older than you, and had like, you know, played with action figures when I was a kid, and they'd be like, you know, plastic dinosaur, army man, cowboy, and finding how would they be they'd have adventures somehow, you know. And then I kind of given up, and then Star Wars came out, and this whole realm of action figures, and I kind of missed the boat on that, you know. But I'm still a big fan of Star Wars, still even more of a fan of Empire, and I could, like, ride my bike to Phipps Plaza Theater and see it, you know, and then, you know, come home, and, like, you had to go down this big hill to get by my house, and I would have, like, the Imperial March kind of roaring in my head, you know, while, you know, swooping down the hill as if, you know, going through the asteroid field, you know. So very attached, but also kind of, and would see all the movies and kind of absorb them all, you know, as both a movie fan and movie critic, you know. So they're big pop events and their sci-fi events, even though they're very light space opera. But not so much a dig into the expanded universe kind of person, although I did read Splinter of the Mind's Eye, you know. But then when I got into podcasts, I became a big fan of Star Wars Minute, especially the original trilogy episodes. So it's like from listening to all of those, kind of absorbed a lot of the Star Wars lore secondhand almost. So it's like I feel like I've got a fair handle on some things without necessarily a firsthand grasp on everything.
Yeah, and you've recommended that podcast to me before, and I do mean to try it out one day.
When there's people like the Flophouse people on it, you might enjoy those, you know. So anyway, but so that's kind of a little context for how we're kind of approaching this, which is a takes place basically immediately after Star Wars Episode IV, A New Hope. So it's like the Death Star has just been blown up, you know, and it's like, how are they dealing with all the stuff? And there is like a series called Star Wars. I guess there was a tie-in series that came in with this.
An ongoing Star Wars series written by Jason Aaron and with art by John Cassaday, at least for the first arc. I'm not sure if he's still on it. And there are some events in Vader that tie into that, and I'll discuss those later.
Yeah, but the Darth Vader book and that book were kind of like mirrors to each other chronologically, where it's like, here's what's going on with Han and Luke and our heroes, you know, on one side of the universe, and Darth Vader's like, what's happening with Darth Vader on another side, and sometimes they kind of intersect, sometimes they completely intersect in a later series called Vader Down, which is fun, but we're just going to talk about the Darth Vader series here, and it's like, and it's part of the appeal of it is that it's like, you know, after, you know, becoming basically arguably the most iconic villain in all of contemporary pop culture, you know, with like Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back, he was never quite at that level again, mostly in Return of the Jedi, but not 100%. And people have kind of like, we kind of want the real Darth Vader again. And this comes really close to giving it. So should we get into our recaps now?
Yeah, well, I'll do the creators.
The creators, yes.
The people responsible for this, for what we're discussing today. Writer, Kieran Gillen. Art by Salvador LaRocca. Colorist, Edgar Delgado. Letterer, VC's Joe Caramagna. And what an odd name that is. Who would name their child VC's? Assistant editors, Heather Antos and Charles Beecham, and editor Jordan B. White.
So, issue one starts. Sith Lord Darth Vader secretly meets with Jabba the Hutt as part of a plan to regain power. Earlier, the Emperor told Vader that, as the only senior Imperial to survive the destruction of the Death Star, Vader bears responsibility. Vader doesn't voice his suspicions about the young pilot who's strong in the Force. Vader hires Boba Fett and Wookiee bounty hunter Black Kersantan for secret missions and leaves a tribe of dead Tusken Raiders in his wake.
Issue 2. Vader rescues an Imperial ship under attack by pirates. He suspects the Empire has a mole feeding the pirates information, but new Grand General Tag has different ideas. Tag assigns an adjutant to keep tabs on Vader. Vader leads a team to the pirate base and makes short work of the place while a droid makes a secret data hack. Vader reveals that the adjutant was the source of the leak and has the droid secretly destroyed.
3. We meet Dr. Aphra, a rogue archaeologist caught stealing an item from a secure museum. Vader rescues her for her access to a secret droid army. Aphra activates the personality matrix of 000, a protocol droid reprogrammed as a murderous torturer. 000 boots up BT-1, a specialized assassin droid with the benign exterior of an R2 unit. They embark on a mission to retrieve battle droids on Geonosis.
4. On Geonosis, Vader, Aphra, and the droids infiltrate the catacombs, battle some of the natives, and steal the Geonosian queen's robot womb factory. Mission accomplished, Aphra asks Vader if he's going to kill her now or later, And Vader says, "You are safe as long as I have use for you." Bounty hunter Black Kersantan delivers the Emperor's mysterious new helper, whom 000 determines was Dr. Silo 4, a scientist charged with gathering Vader's replacements.
5. Team Vader finds Dr. Cyclo's base on the back of a giant whale-like space creature. Vader invades with 2 platoons of droids, where he meets lightsaber-wielding twins, Morit and Aeolin. A new clone of Dr. Cyclo reveals his secret orders to genetically engineer new apprentices for the Emperor who don't use the Force. Vader prepares to kill Cyclo, but the Emperor himself appears and orders Vader and his potential replacements to fight it out.
6. Silo introduces his newly created lieutenants to the Emperor as Vader fights them in turn. Vader battles a Trandoshan, but Morit takes the kill. The Emperor stops the fighting and tells Vader that if he prevails in competition with his rivals, he'll earn his way back to favor. Boba Fett meets Vader and reveals that the young pilot's name is Skywalker. Vader swears loyalty to the Emperor, but privately declares, "I have a son. He will be mine. It will all be mine."
I will say that I got the name Silo wrong. It is Cyclo, and the alien is called Trandoshan, I believe.
Okay. Yeah.
There was a bounty hunter named Bosk, who's like a reptile guy you see in Empire Strikes Back, and this is one of the things that I learned from Star Wars Minute, and Trandoshan is apparently that species, so...
Yeah. Well, I'm going to take the Dave White tack when it comes to Star Wars names. Yeah. You know, they don't matter. They're all like globbity gloop or whatever. Dave White of the Linoleum Knife podcast, which is quickly becoming one of my favorites. Yeah. And thanks for turning me on to that. Okay, so.
Well, one of the things I wanted to start off with this is that there's, I think there's like a kind of a two-pronged challenge with a book like this. And any kind of tie-in work or non-canonical, you know, work that's connected to a movie or a show or something like that. And it's, how do you make this sort of original, non-canonical work that's drawing from another medium do justice to the original source while being in a different medium, you know? And so, and a lot of times, like, comics and novelizations seem like kind of pale shadows of what they're based on, you know? So this is kind of transcends that in a way or you know, gets above that. And it's, like, interesting how they, you know, rise above the limitations of this kind of genre. And the other thing I would say is that it's about Darth Vader, who is this like great towering villain with a lot of mystique. And part of his mystique comes from the fact that you he doesn't say that much and he's kind of mysterious. So how do you develop a character who wears a featureless mask, doesn't talk a lot, usually just speaks in threats when he does talk and without, you know, adding stuff that diminishes to his mystique, you know? And I think they do a lot of stuff that's really interesting, you know?
Yeah, this and in the concurrent Star Wars title by Jason Aaron both do such a good job of exploring this world in a way that, say, the Marvel Star Wars comic from the late 70s and 80s didn't so much. Yeah. I don't know why that is. Partly, I think it's because Roy Thomas started writing, you know, issue 7, which picked up after A New Hope left off. I don't think, if I remember correctly, I don't think he had even seen the finished product.
Yeah, they're like working at a disadvantage where, you know, the current groups are working at an advantage of like, you know, decades of history that they can draw on.
Yes.
Yeah. And one of the things that is kind of one of the most immediately appealing thing about this is that it will use iconic images from the movies and kind of put them in different contexts. Like the first scene in this is Vader arriving at Jabba the Hutt's palace on Tatooine. And it's a mirroring Luke Skywalker arriving at it, you know, kind of almost like shot by shot.
In Return of the Jedi.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. And another thing is that we don't have interior monologue from Darth Vader, which is to the best, you know, but when he's like, he'll be given a memory of something and we'll see basically often a still from the movie. So we recognize it and it has that kind of, you know, as the artist communicating to the reader, it's like, here's that shot from the movie you like so much, you know, but also we know it's like, oh, this is what he's thinking. And we can kind of infer what kind of emotional response he's having to it. So,
right. Without him actually having a Hamlet-level soliloquy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so, and I think that kind of stuff works really nicely here. It might work badly in other contexts, but this particular one works really well.
Yeah, and Gillen does a great job because with a character like Vader, what do you do about a problem like Vader? I liken it to Wolverine mm-hmm. back in the 80s. I think it's unquestionable that he was a stronger character when you didn't know everything about him. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of hubbub about the Origin series mm-hmm. that came out. Was it late 90s or early 2000s?
I don't think I actually read it. So
yeah, yeah. When it's revealed that, you know, he was a sickly young boy named James Hewlett mm-hmm. and, you know, all this other stuff, mm-hmm. like less is more. Mm-hmm. And I was worried about that with the prequels. That turned out to be one of the less bothersome aspects yeah. of the prequels is like, how much do we really want to know about how Anakin Skywalker yeah. becomes Darth Vader?
Turns out we didn't want to know what we found out in a lot of ways. And, yeah. and the prequels also, it's like they kind of teased Vader all along. It's like in like The Phantom Menace, one of the first images was like boy Anakin with like the shadow of Vader behind him. And they right. had trailers with the Darth Vader breathing. And it's like Vader's coming up. He's going to be here just a minute. And then he appears basically in like some of the last scenes, you know, in ways that don't really advance the character that much, you know. I mean, he famously kind of like it gets bad news and goes no, and it's like come on, you know. So in a way, this kind of reclaims the mystique of Darth Vader, you know, kind of back from George Lucas himself in a way.
Yeah, and there are scenes, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. where he sort of has a flashback to a mm-hmm. moment from the prequels, mm-hmm. and so you see Anakin as portrayed by Hayden Christensen, like, say, having his first kiss with mm-hmm. Amidala. And my immediate thought is, evoking the image of mm-hmm. Hayden Christensen isn't yeah. the best way to reclaim,
yeah.
you know, Darth Vader. But it does end up working. He does it sparingly.
Yeah, and that particular shot there in, it's when Dr. Aphra is mentioned there, do you have any memories of, do you have a problem with going to Geonosis or have you been here before? And you see the shot of you know, Hayden Christensen and Natalie Portman kissing, but almost in silhouette, which is like their first kiss, which we know from Attack of the Clones, you know. So it's like, it doesn't dwell on maybe like the bad things about Attack of the Clones. And Vader, you know, we see that shot and Vader says, you know, he kind of brushes it off, you know. So we know he's like thinking about his relationship with her, but we kind of don't know. Yeah. What he's specifically feeling about it.
He says something like, I have no feelings about Geonosis. Yeah, yeah. What, was that James Earl Jones? It feels like he was just in the room with us. It was uncanny. No. So anything about the first couple issues in particular that you want to...
Well, I do want to say just how much I enjoy Vader going to the Darth... I mean, Vader going to Jabba the Hutt's palace. It might be one of my favorite parts in the book, you know. And it's like, it says, it mirrors scenes with like the doors opening it up and Vader coming in the distance in kind of almost in silhouette. And there are the guards and where Luke kind of used the force to harmlessly dispatch them or mostly harmlessly. Vader seems like straight up kills them, right. you know. And so Vader confronts Jabba the Hutt and tells him what he wants. And force chokes him, and so Jabba's like got the his like tongue sticking out, and it's like when Princess Leia was choking Jabba with the chain, you know, and they kind of use the angles that we saw Jabba the Hutt in. And it's almost like if you saw magazines or fanzines that would have like, here's a still of Jabba and here's a different one, they would kind of use those famous like stills and production photos. So
right.
So it's like if you're a fan, it has that goes back that far, it has that other layer of, you know, association, you know. And it's a neat, you know, just sort of dramatic confrontation and stuff like that, you know. And I also wanted to say the book ends like kind of, it's kind of bookended with scenes on Tatooine, the first issue. And like Vader is like talking with Jabba the Hutt and Black Kersantan, the Wookiee bounty hunter, you know.
Oh, you mean Boba Fett?
Boba Fett. And
Black Kersantan.
That's how it's spelled, you know. They kind of like gives him this order, tells him what he wants them to do. And then it kind of backs up, like it's like the quote unquote camera backs up. And there's this big 2-page spread where he's basically massacred this Tusken Raider village. And that's kind of a callback to Attack of the Clones when Anakin's mother had been kidnapped by Tusken Raiders and he had found her. She died in his arms and he killed all of them, even like the women and children. So
he still has issues.
Yeah, yeah.
And where the sand people are concerned.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost like, is this where he gets his only source of pleasure is killing sand people. His only sentiment and representation of how he remembers his life before, you know, it's there's a weird, twisted sentimentality to it almost, you know. I mean, it seems like there might be another level than him just being vengeful, you know. So it's kind of, and it's also kind of like, ugh, he's super bad, in case we hadn't, you know, had any doubts, you know.
Well, so
how about
I do
you
like,
on the first issues? Yeah,
I do like the opening scene with when he comes to Jabba the Hutt and the kind of subterfuge aspect that he's going to be there the next day officially on business for the Emperor, but he's here today on a personal matter, which is basically, we find out, to get the names of some bounty hunters that he can send on these missions. Yeah. There's the obligatory fight, you know, when Jabba the Hutt sends, pretty much just lets everyone in the room loose on him. And I feel like that isn't executed particularly well, just visually. It's hard to follow in some places. But what I like about it is as these first couple issues go on and we see Vader getting a dressing down from Palpatine.
Yeah.
In a way, you could see this as Vader taking out his frustrations.
That's a fair, yeah.
Like, which leads me to one of the things I like best about this book, and it's a delicate balance. It's interesting to see Vader in a position of weakness, especially if your primary vision and memory of the character is from those first two films, when he's enigmatic and he doesn't speak a whole lot and he's pretty much always in control.
Yeah.
And it's very different from Empire, which takes place a little while after all of this does, since this takes place right after Episode 4. Even in Empire, he's completely in control, and everyone is scared of him. And it's interesting to see this, and it's nice to see, you know, that flipped and be different here and know that he's going to work his way back somehow to that in Empire.
Darth Vader's like the underdog in terms of like the Imperial hierarchy in this.
Yeah.
He's on the Emperor's Sith list, you might say.
Well done. Yeah. So I like that the Emperor blames him for the loss of the Death Star. You don't see that really in
It's
Empire.
Very kind of Stalin-esque, where it's like, well, the people who are really responsible are dead, but you're here in front of me, so it's your fault, you know.
And but there's one scene in that, there's one part of that exchange where Vader says, I was not alone in my failings, you know, and he talks about how the Death Star was arrogant to kind of put all its eggs in that super destroying kill base. It doesn't seem like Vader a lot to point the finger at others.
Yeah.
You know, but then we're not used to seeing him, you know, being kind of getting dressed down at all.
he's usually not in a position where he would be defensive, so.
Right. And it's funny because, so Palpatine says that Tag is going to be in control and praises him for arguing about the arrogance of the Death Star right after Vader had said that very same thing. He ignores that, you know, and sort of gives Tag credit for Vader's sentiment, which I thought was a fun touch.
Well, did you see the backstory to Tag and why he's in the book?
No.
He was in Star Wars and he's kind of in like the Death Star like briefing room scene, but was not in kind of the latter half of the movie and is not shown dying in the movie. So they basically
they do make a mention that he left before.
Yeah, but apparently Gillen wanted a military kind of opponent slash rival to Vader. And Wikipedia says that Lucasfilm's story group said, it's like, well, actually, Tag isn't shown dying, so why don't you use Tag, you know? So, yeah. So it's like there's an act. He's like a character who's like on screen in the first movie. I don't think appears again, you know, in the movies. So it kind of fits out, you know. And then he can like, I guess the idea is like he can die between now and, you know, Empire Strikes Back continuity without ruining the continuity.
Right. So then as Vader's meeting with the Emperor, he sees Sylo, who, and the Emperor pointedly doesn't tell Vader who he is. And, you know, like, excuse me, Emperor, your 5 o'clock is here.
Yeah.
Great, send him in. And Vader, to me, uncharacteristically, is like, who is this master? Mm-hmm. Are you trying to hide something from me? Yeah. Again, I like that we see a Vader who's off balance and even insecure, but I feel like the Vader we know from New Hope and Empire wouldn't confront Palpatine directly about his, you know, if he has any suspicions that he, you know, he already knows he's on his Sith list.
Yeah.
That feels a little Hayden to me. Yeah. That he, you know, like, Master, who is this? Hey, why aren't you telling me? You know, anyway, it does read a little bit more like Anakin. And as I said earlier, you want to be really, really sparing with how much you remind people.
You don't really want to think about anyone being inside that mask. You just kind of want to think about the presentation of the mask.
Exactly. Like, yes. Yeah. But then, you know, that does exist. Mm-hmm. You know, the prequels are there and they are canon. And you could say that Gillen is trying to bridge those two versions of the character, because at the end of Revenge of the Sith, you know, you still have a long way to go in Vader's evolution before, before the next trilogy.
Yeah.
And I think that even though this takes place after A New Hope, it's kind of showing you Vader's evolution from, you know, when a disfigured Hayden Christensen gets, you know, his gas mask apparatus and, you know, all this stuff to help keep him alive, and the badass Vader that we see.
We don't know a lot about his, like, rehab process from when he became from, like, volcano victim to cyborg space warlord, you know. Yeah. I want to get to Aphra and the droids. Do you want to? There's so much about issue two that we wanted to say.
I do like when Vader's talking to Tag. Tag says something about Grand Moff Tarkin, and Vader says, "Tarkin had vision. You have graphs." Tag does sort of kind of shine a light on, you know, he refers to Vader, you know, and says, kind of look at yourself as like your lightsaber, a singular weapon from an older time, you know, and there's this running theme that says subcurrent here about the Force sort of being past its prime and not relevant in today's universe.
It's one of those kind of weird, it's kind of a bit of an inconsistency, because if the Emperor uses the Force and Darth Vader does, you'd think that everyone would be into the Force. So it's there's kind of like, well, are they kind of deliberately discrediting this thing that they are exploiting?
You know, but as we see, Vader is alarmed because the Emperor seems to be turning his back on the Force, or at least not embracing it as wholeheartedly as Vader does. Yeah. He's open to other things, you know, as we see with Sylo's, you know, replacements for the Force. And Tag's comment is a little ironic, you know, is like calling Vader a relic of a bygone era, which, you know, Vader is the reason that era is bygone in the first place.
One thing I wanted to, I did want to say about issue two is, like, there's a kind of the big fight scene on the pirate base. And it's an example of a lot of the scenes will have the structure of, like, the panels. They'll be kind of like these long panels, and they'll kind of go kind of just down the page. And it's almost like the fact that they're long and go from, like, one end of the page to the other, they're almost like widescreen movie size and composed, like, movie images a little bit. It's not a perfect match, but it's almost like maybe that's kind of part of the visual vocabulary they're subtly doing to say that's, like, it's kind of like movie storyboard composition as much as kind of more conventional Marvel, you know, from classic Marvel composition. Yeah. You know?
Before we get to Aphra, the last thing I want to say is, so his adjutant that Tag is assigned to him, Un-I, I guess, is his name, is going through his records and sees, you know, finds records of his communications with Boba Fett.
Yeah.
And you're like, dude, why are you using your work email for personal business?
He should have a private server, of course.
Exactly. anyway, yeah. So, let's talk about Aphra.
Yeah, it's funny. She's, I feel like they kind of rightly felt that it would be good to have another a woman character in this. And as this sort of rogue thief who's an archaeologist, it's like she's got little bits of, like, Han Solo and Indiana Jones in her, in a way. Like, she doesn't look like Harrison Ford, obviously, although they're both Harrison Ford characters.
And her personality isn't really like him.
No,
But her introduction is a straight-up homage to the opening of Raiders, let's say, you know, in the temple, especially when you have the giant droid that's coming after, and it's got the
force field around it. I didn't even think about that.
And it looks like the rolling boulder
scene. I didn't even think about that. That's great. That's very clever. Yeah. You and in the book, you know. Yeah. So they wanted to have, and she's quote unquote a, I guess, hottie, one would say, you know, she has to be kind of a young, you know, conventionally attractive woman, you know, so, which is like not the most interesting way to do it, you know, but she provides kind of a counterpoint to Vader because she talks a lot and he doesn't talk much, obviously. You
know? I think that's partly to make her more relatable to the reader because you need someone that you can focus on a little bit more than Vader. Of course, you know, she's kind of amoral and well, kickstarts these two, you know, murderous droids. Yeah. So how relatable can she really be?
Yeah, I want to get to them in a second. But that's the good point because she's like chatty, like kind of a likable nerd character, like we see like a lot of women characters who aren't defined by their sexuality tend to be in media. They tend to be funny and they talk a lot, you know.
Yeah. She is very chatty. She's sort of like a evil space Lorelai Gilmore.
Well, she's not. At first it's like, it's kind of vague as to how evil she actually is.
Right.
But the fact that, because she like, early on she kind of reads as, you know, someone who steals but isn't evil, you know.
Well, she is, like I said, amoral at best. Yeah.
But she's like, reveals that she's like super on board with being a Vader loyalist, you know, and that he represents something powerful that she is drawn to. So it's like there's a piece missing in her character that we get in this, because she seems like she's kind of super on board with following the most evil guy in the universe, no matter what he does, you know.
I think part of that is there's a line, and I don't know that don't have the actual line on the tip of my tongue, but I think it's when she's talking about how he'll kill her when and if he ultimately does, that she's just glad that she's been able to be part of something important, you know.
It's like her blood will be a doodle in the margins of history or something like that.
Yeah, rather than just kind of, you know, doing these bits and pieces, odd jobs for different people. And also she's going along because I think she knows that she doesn't really have a choice. Yeah. And she's putting the best face on it. Yeah. And you're right. It does feel like there's something missing. And I'm glad we don't get any hint that there are like unresolved daddy issues or anything like that.
It might be that they want to have plans for the character outside of this. And so they wanted her to not be too dark so they can have her in a more lighthearted context, you know.
I believe she does is getting her own title, too.
Yeah. Actually, I was at a comic book store yesterday, and my daughter bought Dr. Aphra number one.
Oh, it's out.
Yeah, it's out. And I meant to read it before we recorded, and I forgot, you know. So, so it's out. So, so they have her, and she's, you know, kind of a female sidekick, you know, basically.
Slash audience surrogate, kind of, sort of.
Yeah, but we also have 000 and BT-1. And I've got to say, I am so on board with 000. I cannot tell you.
I love he's like the MVP of these. Yeah.
And he is like, basically, he's like 3PO, you know, voiced by Anthony Daniels, as a sadistic torturer and murderer, you know. Yeah. And so he has this, basically the same speech patterns and kind of fussy loquaciousness as 3PO, only with these overt threats written in there, you know. And one of them, he says, as there's no one here to murder presently, how may I be of assistance, you know? And,
when she activates him and he goes to, like, shake hands with one of them, and Aphra gives the command that lets him know that they are to be his masters. And he's like, oh, but I better not shake your hand. Because he had some sort of murderous
joy buzzer, I guess. Yeah. So he is, I would so much like him to kind of get the promotion to movies or television so Anthony Daniels can actually do the voice, because he is just a great creation, you know.
And I love that Yeah, he is the anti-C-3PO, and he's, you know, murderous and lethal, but he's still just as prickly. Like when he, at one point when Vader offers him to do something, I have had more grateful masters. And BT-1 says something to him, and he says, politeness costs nothing. Yeah. I love that.
And one thing, it's like, just the voice through the dialogue is so vivid that even if you, had never seen any Star Wars and didn't kind of know that they're doing a 3PO riff, the character would come across very vividly anyway, I think. Yeah. I have to kind of like take that on faith because I know the character so well. Right. But is he's like kind of the strongest character apart from Vader in this in a lot of ways. And BT-1 is like fine, but it's not really a character on the same level. He's just like R2-D2 who just kills everything, which is pretty appealing and amusing, you know, in itself. Yeah.
The efficacy of R2 and BB-8 and droids of that nature, you really do need to have that extra visual and auditory AV, if you will, component to really get, you know, the cuteness of those characters in, or the way that they, you know, use the beeps and everything as a language, you know, and, you know, when R2's upset and makes a little, you know, like those sorts of things, those little personality shortcuts you can't really do here as effectively.
Yeah.
So BT does suffer by comparison for a number of reasons.
Yeah. So so I want to say this, like, and it's funny, R2-D2 is a astromech droid, which is something that was probably there for the knowing, but I never really knew until I listened to Star Wars Minute. And Dr. Aphra says that BT-1 is a blastomech prototype, you know, which is an amusing little joke, you know. Yeah. So should we get into the Geonosis part? Yeah.
As we mentioned, when Dr. Aphra says, kind of asks him, you know, how do you feel about going to Geonosis? Mm. And it's weird that she would just ask that out of nowhere. But I do want to talk a little bit about Vader's emotional response or lack thereof.
Yeah, one thing, the Geonosis part itself is, the action scene is like, you know, fun scenes are like kind of fun and, you know, Triple Zero gets lots of kind of funny moments, you know, and there are some of the native Geonosians who we see in Attack of the Clones appear, and they end up, he and BT-1 end up killing them all, and he says in their language while leaving, like, ha ha ha, you are on fire and also dead, you know? Yes. So that's kind of, you know, their kind of very dark comic relief aspects.
Yeah.
And they find this alien queen, and I don't believe it's a character that we ever saw in Attack of the Clones, but she looks like the alien queen Xenomorph from the movie Aliens. So it's like a riff on a different 1980s sci-fi film saga.
I read that she may appear in the Clone Wars. Mm-hmm.
The cartoon series.
Series. But regardless, it does look that there's a little bit of a cleaned up Geiger look to it.
So, and it's like, it's all kind of like fun action stuff. Not so great that it's like transcendent action stuff, I would say, like some kind of like classic action scene you have to see. But it's all very, you know, exciting and propulsive, and I'm interested as it goes along, you know.
It is, but I think part of the reason that it's not as super urgent as you were just saying is there's not really stakes,
right?
You know,
I think that's true.
You're watching a bad guy sort of amass his army, you know, and Vader isn't the most sympathetic character, even though he's the protagonist of the book. So it's hard to have personal stakes.
Yeah.
And I think Aphra helps with that a little bit, but still you're just along for the ride. You're not, you know, and I think that's all these middle issues are. Mm-hmm. And it's fun, yeah.
Apart from Triple Zero, all of the droids he gets don't have any personalities to speak of. You know, BT-1 to a lesser extent, you know, but otherwise it's just kind of generic droid soldiers from like the Phantom Menace, basically.
Yeah, I was going to say that very prequely template.
Yeah. So, should we get into 5 and 6?
Yes.
Yeah. Because I find these a little anticlimactic, frankly, you know, because it's like this big buildup to these potential replacements, and they're genetically engineered so they're not force sensitive. But none of them seem that, like, there'll be eventually matches for Vader at all. It's like the fact that there's like 5 or 6 of them is, you know, Yeah. That's kind of like their biggest point, because otherwise they don't seem like, it seems like he could take them out easily, you know. One thing that struck me as kind of funny, though, is that they have the twins that are presented to us, and it says that they've been kind of training and modifying them for like 19 years. So they're basically as old as twin Luke and Leia, so it's almost like if they had kept Luke and Leia, this is what they might have been like.
Right, yeah, I was going to say that Vader won't get this yet, but they are kind of a nod to the audience, to like, just like you have 000 and BT, that this is a version of like an evil or at least a bad guy, Luke and Leia.
Yeah, it's a little bit subtler than the other two, because they don't. Yes. It's not like they look like Mark Hamill and Carrie Fisher, you know.
Yeah, she doesn't have the buns.
But it's like there's a you know, the Bosk, the kind of the reptile one has like, doesn't feel pain. And there's one with a Mon Calamari head and robot body. Mon Calamari was, the Admiral Akbar aliens, you know.
And I love that those are called calamari.
Yes. Yeah. And he's got, a design that's like General Grievous, who was like the android from Revenge of the Sith, with like the twirling lightsabers. Yeah. It's like, none of them are that scary or intimidating, and so it's almost like they introduce them just to kind of a fight and then stop fighting. It's like, well, you'll fight more again later, you know. Yeah. So it's like a lot of kind of build up, and it's like, and then it just kind of moves on, you know.
And there are some scenes there, like I think it's Morit is the male.
Mm-hmm. I think so, yeah.
Who does two things. One, he kills one of them who's about to kill Vader, and Vader says that was my, he was mine.
Yeah, he's pretty irritated by that. Yeah.
But Morit kind of says pretty explicitly that, like, you're the old guard, move out of the way. Mm-hmm. You know, the Force is irrelevant. Mm-hmm. And all of this troubles Vader, like, when it's all done, or even before then, when the Emperor does show up, he says, this is blasphemy. These are not of the Force.
Yeah.
And as I said, the Emperor is cool with exploring other alternatives, shall we say.
Yeah, it does kind of hint at the fact that Vader has this almost faithful religious aspect to the Force that's not really explored very much. It's kind of more implicit than explicit, but it's an element of his character that we don't really... It's almost like he's got some religious zealotry almost when it comes to the Force.
And I would like to see at some point a story that bridges the gap between Revenge of the Sith and Episode 4. Because if, correct me if I'm wrong, but if I recall, in Revenge of the Sith, it's Palpatine and throughout the trilogy who's hammering Anakin with the Force.
Yeah.
And he doesn't necessarily seem like he buys in really until he has his, until he snaps at the end.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems a little out of character for Palpatine based on what we had seen in Revenge of the Sith about the dark side of the Force.
Yeah, and, I want to see where Vader fully bought in.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. But the last issue has one of the best parts for me is, like, when Boba Fett tells him, his name is Skywalker, and there's, like, a sequence of, shots from the movie. It's like, here's him with, Vader fighting Obi-Wan Kenobi, in Episode 4, and him flying his TIE fighter and saying the Force is strong with this one, and some scenes from the other comics where he had actually apparently met Luke before and seen his old lightsaber.
I think it's in the second issue of the Jason Aaron run, and I'll get to that in a minute. They do have a meeting that kind of presages the one that they'll have in Empire, and Darth Vader doesn't know who he is yet, but gets more kind of context clues.
Yeah.
I think the first two issues take place before Vader starts, and then there are some moments where they kind of refer to and dovetail with each other.
Yeah.
Go on.
Yeah. And then he's like, there's this kind of Force wave, and like the glass that he's standing in front of is all cracked, but doesn't, it's like you get a sense of contained rage and this sort of dark epiphany,
Yeah.
And then he like contacts the Emperor and says that he kind of effectively apologizes and swears loyalty and stuff like that. And
does not mention Luke at all.
And doesn't mention that. And then he has the it will all be mine kind of thing. And he's standing at the window and there are like Star Destroyers in the background. And you can almost hear the bum, 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 bum,
bum, bum, bum, bum, bum. Yeah, it's a nice ending. And what I like is that, if you follow the series enough, this is implicitly there's a reading that these are the seeds of Vader's decision that he's going to replace the Emperor and how he's grooming Luke to become his Padawan, his number two in Empire when he says, "Join me and we'll overthrow the Emperor." And don't forget that, as you mentioned about doing the math with Morit and Aeolin, Vader has a, what's the word? Vader has a pretty bitter realization you know, this isn't just some new plan he's been cooking up.
The Emperor has had this in mind
all along.
And he realized that, you know, the Emperor lied to him about, you know, Padme and his children dying, you know, and, you know, so he's got like even more of a grudge against the Emperor at this point.
The Emperor has been considering replacing him pretty much since the climactic battle on Mustafar, at the end of Revenge of the Sith, where he effectively becomes Darth Vader. He's been disappointed in him even, you know, since the beginning of Darth Vader.
Yeah.
And so that's got to be, you know, that's got to be shaking
Wait
as
a
well.
Minute. Yeah. Yeah. There's a nice Easter egg in that last part when he calls the Emperor, because the Emperor looks like he did in Empire Strikes Back the first time we ever see him, where he's played by a different actor than Ian McDiarmid, who we would see in the other ones. And in the special edition, they went back and put Ian McDiarmid in, but this is like, looks like the original one. And one of the weird things about this presentation is that it's like a British actor's voice, I believe, a elderly actress kind of who we see, and the eyes are, the rumor is, chimp eyes. Like they had eyes of a chimp and kind of superimposed them, so they look kind of weird. And on Star Wars Minute, they talked about that, and then they call them Emperor Chimp Eyes, which is always, you know, kind of a little joke that's stuck with me. You
know? I did not know that.
So, little Easter egg there.
You know? Okay, so any other things we want to mention, or do we want to get right into the reckoning?
I think I'm ready to get into the to our reckoning.
Okay, so like you mentioned, you are much more of this material than I am, although I enjoyed a great deal. So why don't you go first?
Okay, well, first we should say that in our reckoning, it's like we need to have a vote and it needs to be unanimous.
Right,
and
thank you.
We like to evaluate whether something, you know, qualifies for the comics canon. You know, does it have iconography as a story? Is it have creative excellence? Does it have lasting influence, or that sort of X factor that makes it unique? You know, and one of the
cultural, or I hesitate to say historic importance, but you know, some kind of impact, some kind of reach beyond just the page.
Yeah, and with this, it's kind of interesting because we're dealing with something that is inherently derivative of another medium. And I don't mean derivative in the pejorative sense, but that it's deriving from the Star Wars movies. So how much do you need the movies to appreciate it? And how important is that in the judgment, you know? Because I was thinking about how, like, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, you know, they're in a way it's influence and derivative of all this, like, historical stuff. So it helps to know the references to appreciate the thing, you know? So with this one, it works very well and is very entertaining, you know, and riffs on the movies a lot. At the same time, I feel like it's still super dependent on the movies. And, you know, I feel like, as much as I enjoy this and I enjoy the subsequent ones, I'm going to kind of draw a line and say that I'm not going to qualify this for the comics canon. So I'm going to vote no, even though I like it a lot. And the fact that I wanted to have a discussion reflects well on it, you know, and I'm just going to say, you know, maybe not this one 100%. So, yeah.
I agree. Mm-hmm. And for most of the reasons you mentioned, it's a fun story. Mm-hmm. And as we've talked about before, say with Black Panther, like, it's a story that's still in progress.
Yeah.
This is really just one chapter in the Darth Vader series, which is finite, that we should mention. And I believe Kieran Gillen had an end in mind from the very beginning.
Yeah, I think issue 25 is where it ends. Yeah.
So, you know, we have to take that into account. Mm-hmm. And it does give you some nice glimpses into his character, and it's not easy to do, as we mentioned, and he does a really good job of it. Mm-hmm. And there are fun bits.
Yeah.
But that said, like, yeah, it doesn't feel like important within the context of, you know, the rest of the Star Wars universe.
Yeah. And this is not to, like, say that there's anything wrong with it, because it's super entertaining and it does its job very well.
Right.
You know? And it's probably, you know, we'll get to like our recommendations a little bit later. And it's like, I tried to think of like some other kind of tie-in book to recommend and could not think of any, you know? So this is like probably the best thing of its kind I can think of, you know? So,
right.
Yeah. It just doesn't quite fit, you know, the, our, you know, criteria for how we're doing the comics canon. So,
all right. Anyways. So sorry, Darth Vader.
Yeah. Better luck next time.
Please don't kill us.
Yeah.
Okay, and so now let's move into our ever-popular segment, Kurt's Classic Comics Ad Corner.
Yeah, it's popular with me, I guess, and I guess you, so we'll just assume that it's popular for other people. But this one I picked because it has a light tie-in to Star Wars.
And oh, yeah, it's I can see it.
Yeah, it's the Tom Corbett's Space Cadet Invisible Helmet, and it has like this sort of like diving helmety kind of thing, you know, with like a ovoid face thing. Have fun. It's like magic. Amazing. Thrilling. Join the space parade with this great invisible helmet. Your friends will rave. Be a super space cadet. Nobody will be able to recognize you when you wear this amazing invisible helmet. Because when people look at your face, they'll see only their own reflection. But you'll be able to see them, and you'll be thrilled at everyone's amazement. Only $1.98, and it's got this sort of glowing starburst thing of, like, the effect, and it's got, like, a guy with a helmet on, and looks like green tights with kind of a, like a circus strongman one-piece bathing suit thing and, like, orange gloves, and, like, there's a woman admiring him and, like, a younger boy kind of leaning in for a closer look, you know. So, gentlemen, please send me, it says gentlemen for the mailer in. It's this assuming that women wouldn't be interested in this for some reason. I like the idea that it's, like, kind of oxymoronic because it's an invisible helmet. The helmet itself is visible. Your face is just kind of concealed in it. So it's not like a goldfish bowl and people can see straight through it, you know. So I question the, you know, I've lack of faith in this invisible helmet. You know, so.
Okay, so I want to get into a bit of business real quick. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the invisible helmet, and the first thing I thought of was the invisible swordsman from The Three Amigos. Mm-hmm. And
I have never seen Three Amigos.
Oh, yeah. How about that? And that is something that came up in a pair of podcasts that I recently guested on. In the coming weeks, I'm going to be guesting on the Realist podcast, which counts down the American Film Institute's top 100 American movies. And I will be discussing The Wild Bunch on December 27th, and Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times. That episode drops on January 3rd, the day before this comes out.
Yeah, excellent. You should be sure and plug that on our like Facebook group and stuff like
that. Yeah, I will.
So I'll certainly remember to.
So they're both available by the time you hear this, so please give them a listen. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, our regular Canon Fodder feature featuring letters from users. As you know, we are on SoundCloud as part of the hoary hosts of podcasting. Mm-hmm. And we recently got this message. Hi, The Comics Canon. Episode 21 Flashpoint is a really cool song. You should increase your profile views and number of plays to attract more fans. Going to upload some of my MP3s soon, and I would like your opinion on how to get more fans. One of my friends is using softwares like SoundCloud Automator to grow his audience. Let me know what you think. Cheers. Name redacted.
Yes. Well, thank you. We appreciate that. You know,
I do feel like it's a cool song.
We enjoy Flashpoint. I think was one of our better songs. It's my dream that, you know, one of our episodes will be in the top 40 one day. You know, so yeah.
I would like to see like one of our bits to sort of get animated and get the kind of auto-tune treatment on YouTube.
Yeah. I think that would end up very well.
Yeah. Kind of like Rocket Crocodile in the World of Tomorrow. I used to work about 12 years ago. Mm. I worked at a small independent newspaper. Mm. And in the early days, we had trouble getting mail. Mm-hmm. But we had a letters page that we had to fill. And so this wasn't my decision, but I loved it. Our editor printed one of those spam emails from a Nigerian prince. Uh-huh. And the sort of subhead at the top was, "Hey, we got a letter from a Nigerian yeah. prince!" Uh-huh. Exclamation point. Mm. I've always loved that.
So we're going into the end. We have our recommendations on our spinner rack segment. So all these segments, we're just snapping through the segments, you know, like crazy. And I'll go first. I wanted to do a recommendation by something by Kyron Gillen. So I chose his story, Journey into Mystery, Fear Itself, which is the first volume of his on Journey into Mystery, which was the title that launched Thor.
And it's back in the
60s. And it's a tie-in with Thor, but the main character is another famous villain. He takes Loki, you know, the trickster, and who had basically died in continuity right before this. And in this, he's brought back to life as a young boy of about, like, 10 years old or so. And so he's super mischievous and kind of a schemer. And he's like in Asgard, but he's like on a smartphone, you know, hanging out, you know, and stuff like that. So he's kind of like using his scheming powers for good and plotting against these other villains and working them against each other and all that. It's a very appealing concept and well executed. And it does like another kind of point of view of the Asgard mythos that the Marvel Comics has. So it's a fun kind of thing. It's a little convoluted, I will say, the plotting, but it's really an engaging idea.
Loki kind of is getting the Doctor Who treatment. He was a 10-year-old boy. Yeah. He was a woman.
Yeah.
At one point when Thor returned after Thor had been dead
for a while. He was a woman in the Dark Reign episode.
Right.
Yeah. And he's like kind of a teenager young man in these Agents of Asgard storylines where he's a little older and still kind of as a good guy. I don't like them as much. My daughter actually likes them more than the kid Loki ones from the Journey into Mystery ones.
And so. He's still, I think, a teenager in Gillen's run on Young Avengers where he pops up. Yeah. Bit.
And I wanted to mention actually two fan films because I was thinking about Darth Vader and you know fan work in addition to like the other work that we've been the canonical work and kind of the fan stuff. And one is actually a film called Darth Maul Apprentice, which has this adventure with Darth Maul being the protagonist, or I guess the antagonist / anti-hero, where he's hunting down these Jedi, and it's pretty well done. It's not perfect, but it's executed at a pretty high level. So if you're interested in seeing more Darth Maul and seeing a fan film that how they can be pretty good, that's a good example. The other is a straightforward comedic one, and it's called Chad Vader Day Shift Manager. And it's part of a series about Darth Vader's brother, who looks exactly like Darth Vader. It's the same suit. Well, he's working as the day shift manager of a grocery store and acting like Darth Vader among all these normal people. And the opening scene has a wonderful exchange where he says, saying to like the stock boy, "You have failed me for the last time." And the stock guy says, "That's what you said the last time." And Vader says to him, "I have been too forgiving in the past. Do not fail me again. Because that's the last time." And Vader's like, "Yes, no, I don't know. Never mind." You know, so like a flustered, confused Darth Vader voice is always very funny to me.
I thought you were going, when you said a comedic one, I thought maybe you were going with Hardware Wars.
Yeah, no, I think we've actually kind of risen above Hardware Wars. Even though Hardware Wars, it's kind of the first of its kind, right. Really.
Okay, so I am going to recommend the aforementioned Star Wars run by Jason Aaron and John Cassaday. The first six issues in particular form a really good arc that, as I mentioned before, dovetails with scenes in this book. Mm. And it's really well done. You get a little more of a sense of Leia and Luke, especially as characters. Mm-hmm. They always seem kind of a bit undercooked character-wise in the trilogy and in some of the expanded universe stuff, which is now no longer canon, that I've been exposed to. And the second arc also has some fun moments where we meet Han Solo's wife.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right. I forgot. I heard about that, but never actually read those, you know.
So, yeah, it's some fun stuff.
Yeah.
I don't have anything deep or meaningful to say about it, but if you like Star Wars and you want to scratch that itch, but as this book does, that will go a long way toward it.
Yeah, I have some sympathy for people who were super invested in the expanded universe and then were told that what they thought was canon is now not canon. Right. But at the same time, it's like, okay, none of this is real. So yeah. It's like being told that thing you knew was not real is even less real. You know, it's like you can't get that attached, I would say, you know.
Yeah.
Although who am I to judge? I have a comic book podcast. So, you know, I'm pretty attached on my own ways.
As am I, but it reminds me when I worked in a comic book store and the manager used to joke about the, you know, the covers that would say, not an imaginary story. It's like, because aren't they all?
They are all imaginary stories, yes. So anyway, I guess I'll get into what we're doing next time. And next time we're going to be talking about Hellblazer: Dangerous Habits by Garth Ennis and Will Simpson. There's a animated film of Justice League Dark coming up early in 2017, and the character of John Constantine is a character in it, and we realized, you know, that he's such a presence in the DC universe, I should say. He like has had his own movie with Keanu Reeves. He had his own short-lived television show. That it's like we should talk about John Constantine. This is a good reason to. And the Dangerous Habits arc is probably the most famous and kind of outstanding of the arcs. So that was kind of the obvious choice.
Well, it does very much influence the Keanu Reeves film. Mm-hmm. Pretty much takes part of its
plot DNA.
Yeah, from that. I might argue with you about being the best storyline.
Well, not to say it's outstanding, but it's kind of the most famous. If you had to name one, you'd probably think of that as the first one.
I will agree with that.
So meanwhile, the Comics Canon can be found on the hoary hosts of podcasting, iTunes, SoundCloud, Google Play, and Stitcher, as well as our website, comicscanon.com.
And meanwhile, we want to hear from you. Rate and review the show on iTunes. It really helps us out a lot. You can also email us at letters@comicscanon.com. Let us know your favorite expanded universe stories, dead or alive. Let us know if you agree or strongly disagree with Darth Vader not making the cut. Darth Vader, I hope you're not still listening.
Yeah.
Because we don't want you to get in touch with us. You can post or comment on our Facebook page. You can also hit us up on Twitter @TheComicsCanon, and we'll read your correspondence in a future episode. This podcast was recorded by Grayson Bergman. For The Comics Canon, I'm Kevin Morrow.
And I'm Kurt Holman. The Comics Canon will be continued next time with Hellblazer: Dangerous Habits, and the Force will be with you always.